Welcome to Shifting Mindsets for Better Health, a podcast series produced by our partners at Central Michigan University with a grant from the Children's Foundation. COVID-19 has impacted the lives of millions. Sharing information among healthcare professionals is going to be key to saving lives and improving outcomes. This podcast series brings together healthcare professionals across disciplines to share insight into the far-reaching effects this pandemic has on children, caretakers, and medical care providers.
Whatever their brain thinks of as healthy eating seems to be a recipe for things going to an extreme.
If you engage with positive content, pro-social content, we see better outcomes.
This episode is the impacts of social isolation on children during the pandemic. In March 2020, children were not going to school, not seeing friends, and faced isolation with their families. Dr. Sarah Domoff is a clinical psychologist at the Center for Children, Family, and Communities at Central Michigan University and a professor in CMU's Department of Psychology. One area of Dr. Domoff's research is screen use and children.
I have several studies looking at how children use screens from both the perspective of what makes it problematic, is there risky types of screen media use that parents and teachers and clinicians should be aware of? How do we screen for that? How do we identify it? And then what do we do? How do we treat it or address it? Of the several studies I carry out, some are more focused on descriptive, so what children's screen media use looking like right now during the pandemic, as well as based on intervention. So can we use a school-based program to promote healthy digital media use? And we also have a clinical trial looking at how does improving foundational skills in parenting potentially reduce risks associated with excessive screen time, such as obesity risk and so forth. Screen time consists of all of the hours put together that one has involving digital media technology use. So if you think about it, the number of hours one watches TV, plays video games, browses the internet, goes on social media, uses their phone. So basically, the amount of time that anyone spends using a device with screens or watches media through screens. So radio, listening to the radio and music, in my opinion, that doesn't fall under screen time per se, but that is technically media use. And then reading as well, as if it's not on a Kindle, if it's on a traditional book, that would not fall under the category of screen time, though looking at magazines and reading does fall under the domain of media use. We see the content can really drive the effects that we've been seeing or the correlates of screen media use, meaning that if you engage with positive content, pro-social content, we see better outcomes. If you're looking at playing violent video games, watching violence on TV, consuming online pornography, the content matters, and that can connect to associate with negative outcomes such as aggression, distorted beliefs about what relationships consist of, and so forth. So when we think about screen time, it's really important to consider the content, so what children and adolescents see, as well as the context of their use. Specifically, when are they viewing screens? When are they watching TV? When are they using phones and tablets and going on social media, playing video games? And so if we think about it, there's a lot of nuance and complexity when it comes to whether or not screen media use, digital media use is good or bad. It can be either depending on what the child sees when they're using screens and then also how they're engaging with screen. For example, if you have a teen who uses social media to connect with friends that they care about, that teen may have different outcomes compared to a teen that is passively scrolling through social media, comparing themselves in negative ways to others. It's also what one brings to the table, how one uses screens. And that means for us, in terms of researchers and clinicians, that it's a skill that we can teach. We can teach teens to engage in social media in healthier ways and make better choices about who they follow and how they choose to engage with social media. Another important component of considering how digital media, screen media impacts children and adolescents is to consider their developmental stage. For younger children, an example of good screen time or healthy digital media use would be those television programs that have been developed by developmental psychologists, scientists, educators, designed to teach skills, designed to promote healthy social emotional development. So specifically, if you think of Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood or Sesame Street, those programs scaffold children's learning of problem solving skills, communicating feelings, the importance of being a good friend. The research has shown us that children who watch such programs actually have better social emotional outcomes compared to children who don't. Now, for older children, some of the research that I carried out during the pandemic has found that for teens in particular, if they are having positive online social interactions with friends, with loved ones, they feel like they get support from their peers. They feel like they're connected to their family members. They may not have been able to see during the pandemic. Those teens report feeling less lonely during the pandemic compared to teens who say that their online social interactions have been negative. They feel like they've been put down, victimized, don't feel as connected to those who they engage with online. So there's negative impacts depending on the content, we know what younger children see, as well as the engagement. So how teens are engaging with others online and if it's positive versus negative.
Screen use can be both beneficial and detrimental, but what about the amount of time? Dr. Domoff explains.
In terms of the pandemic's impact on the number of hours of screen media use or digital media use, there have been some studies that have come out looking at within cohort differences. So looking at pre-adolescence before the pandemic to what they're doing right now, as well as trends that we've seen in terms of like nationwide estimates before and after. So a recent study just came out looking at within cohort differences, meaning these same kids before the pandemic and during the pandemic, how has their screen media use changed? For that study, the researchers found that for 9 to 10-year-olds, on average before the pandemic, they spent about 4 hours per day using screens. During the pandemic, now this is a couple years later, so keep in mind that they're older, so they're naturally going to have more screen time, but still, their amount of screen time more than doubled. So they're now getting closer to 8 hours, so 7.7 hours of screen media use per day. Now this is with adolescents. Other studies have suggested that there's been a near doubling in the amount of time spent online for children during the pandemic. So specifically, a group called Parents Together surveyed parents around the country, and they found that 49% of children are now spending more than 6 hours online per day compared to only 8-ish% of children before. So we are seeing a massive increase in the amount of time spent online, as well as the amount of time spent online unsupervised. We are seeing increases in recreational screen time in addition to the screen time that's necessary for engaging in virtual schooling. So it's not just a factor of being online for school. It's likely the fact that so much of our activities had to go online, as well as had to stop because of risks associated with not being able to socially distance. We, in terms of my own research, have found that there is an increase in screen time. There's some evidence that social media use has gone up, but it's not necessarily connected to problematic or dysregulated social media use, meaning that adolescents are still using a lot of social media to connect with others, and the pandemic, at least in the early stages of it, has not necessarily increased the risk for excessive social media use. That those youth who still had problematic media use before the pandemic remain that way, we're not seeing a huge increase in the problematic types of media use that I study. One main area of research for me is looking at when does our social media use become problematic, dysregulated. For teens, we were already seeing high engagement with social media before the pandemic. In terms of my research, we've looked at how teens experience excessive media use. Is it interfering with their functioning? Is it interfering with their academics and so forth? One study we conducted in Peru has found that from pre to the start of the pandemic, we didn't really see a huge increase in the problematic or dysregulated media use. It remained about the same. However, we also know that social media use is fluid, it changes. And for some children, for some adolescents, social media use can increase if they feel like they're not as connected to others. What I think is really compelling about this research is that it's really the engagement with social media that may dictate how or why some youth may have problems with social media, meaning that for those who engage in negative online social interactions, they feel like they're not connected with others or they're victimized online. Those youth experience more negative outcomes than youth who engage in more pro-social or have better positive online social interactions with others. And in fact, youth who have greater depression, anxiety, those youth see a greater increase in their problematic media use rather than youth who have more resilient factors.
Adults can have an impact on children's use of screens. Dr. Domoff has advice for parents and caregivers.
There are so many things that parents can do to promote healthy digital media use. As much as we hear about the negatives when it comes to technology and media use, parents can have a huge role in a variety of ways. So first, it's helping your child engage with content that's appropriate for their age. And there's some great resources online, for example, through Common Sense Media, where they review TV shows, YouTube channels, movies, video games. So first, it's choosing appropriate content. So we know that we can't completely get away from screens. Secondly, it's when children use screen media, or digital media, their phones. We know that the links between screen time and negative outcomes such as poor well-being, internalizing symptoms such as anxiety, depression, a lot of that's mediated or explained by how our digital media use interrupts our sleep. So if we can keep screens out of the bedroom, if we can not use screens an hour before bedtime and after bedtime, we can see a big impact there in terms of some of the risks associated with excessive screen media use. And then finally, it's communicating with your child, your adolescent, about what they're doing online, what they're seeing. Talking to them about how there may be people who contact them online who aren't safe, who aren't who they say they are, and who are not appropriate to talk with. And that if you happen to speak to someone or text someone or engage with someone online that you later find out is not who they say they are, or they've asked you to send something that you wish you didn't send, it's not your fault. You can get help, and they're the ones to blame. And so I think also having those ongoing conversations with your child as they continue to develop, they're going to look different. These conversations are going to look different. But having these conversations about how to be safe, how to protect your privacy, what to do if you make a mistake online, and how you as the parent can help them address that is going to be really key. We've seen concerning rates of exploitation of children online during the pandemic. And that's definitely an area that not many people talk about to the degree that they should. So helping children understand what to do if they've had a major conflict online or if they've shared something that they wish they didn't share is so important. And making sure not to blame or shame your child for that and help them understand how to be safer and what to do if something like that happens is really critical.
Increased screen use was not the only impact of social isolation on children during the pandemic. Dr. Terrell Bravender is a physician and division director of adolescent medicine at the University of Michigan C.S. Mott Children's Hospital and professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at the University of Michigan's College of Medicine. Dr. Bravender specializes in eating disorders and explains the impact the pandemic had on eating disorder treatment centers.
So we don't know specifically how it's impacted the population-based rate. We don't have data on that yet. However, multiple eating disorder treatment centers have seen an increase in both the numbers of referrals in for treatment and the number of patients with really severe eating disorders admitted to the hospital. Our group here at Mott Children's Hospital found more than a doubling in the number of patients admitted with the most severe complications of eating disorders, so those needing medical admission for stabilization of the physical health effects of malnutrition. We are also part of a multi-site quality improvement group that's based in about 16 different adolescent medicine eating disorder treatment centers around the country. And every one of the participating clinics have seen an increase in referrals in for eating disorders since the COVID pandemic started. So when people discuss eating disorders, they usually refer to two main types of eating disorders, although there are a variety of them. The most commonly thought of eating disorder is anorexia nervosa, which is a disorder that is predominantly manifested by a distorted body image, restrictive eating, severe weight loss, and the distorted body image piece of it, along with the fear of gaining weight, are the key pieces of that. So patients with anorexia nervosa often will not be able to tell that they're malnourished while those around them do notice it. Other eating disorders that people consider include bulimia nervosa, which is a disorder manifested by recurrent binge eating and some kind of purging behavior. We usually think of that as being self-induced vomiting, but the purging behavior can be of many other types of purging behaviors, including over-exercising, fasting, laxative use, or diet pill use as a compensatory mechanism for that binge. There are other eating disorders that we frequently see, including one that we often see in younger children called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, which sometimes goes by the acronym ARFID. And this is a disorder in which those dealing with it have similar symptoms to anorexia nervosa, but they may not vocalize or tell people that they want to lose weight. They may not have the body image distortion, but they have an inability to eat adequate food. Maybe in a 10 or 11-year-old who doesn't have the cognitive maturation to be able to say why they're afraid to eat, but they remain afraid to eat. The reason why treatment seeking and the assumed rates of anorexia nervosa have increased is a great question. We don't know specifically why, but there are many theories as to why this might be. Anecdotally, many of my own patients have told me that with the social isolation that happens with the COVID pandemic and the disruption in normal day-to-day activities for kids, they found themselves either bored or seeing themselves repeatedly, looking at themselves on Zoom classroom and looking at themselves all day, spending more time on social media. And many of them decided with the best of intentions to get in better shape or to start eating healthier. And in those at risk for developing eating disorders, that sort of social isolation combined with an emphasis on whatever their brain thinks of as healthy eating seems to be a recipe for things going to an extreme and developing into an eating disorder. Now, it's not going to happen to everybody, and there certainly are genetic and other risk factors for people developing an eating disorder. But that setup of social isolation and disruption of day-to-day activities seems to be the key pieces of this terrible recipe.
The pandemic forced children into social isolation for reasons beyond their control. Most of us felt a loss of control during the pandemic, but this can be problematic for children prone to eating disorders. Dr. Bravender highlights who might be at risk and how they treat patients at Mott Children's Hospital.
There are a number of risk factors that we know about for people that might make it more likely for them to develop eating disorders, particularly for anorexia nervosa. We know that high levels of perfectionism are a risk for anorexia nervosa, and even more worrisome are if a child has high levels of perfectionism and still has a low self-worth. If somebody wants everything to be perfect but never thinks they are good enough, that is a setup for an eating disorder, and parents and medical providers should be aware of that. The other piece that is incredibly important is very basic for every pediatrician, family practice doc, and primary care provider out there, and that is to monitor the growth charts. Kids should stay along their growth percentiles from the time they're preschoolers all the way through their teenage years. And if they're growing along and their weight is going along a normal percentile and you see a drop off in that, that's something that should be addressed and asked about. Participating in family-based treatment for anorexia nervosa is very difficult for families. And We always tell our families, if it were easy, we wouldn't have an intensive program here. And it's particularly difficult because some of our patients with anorexia nervosa got to having anorexia nervosa because of their need to control their lives in general. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen an increase in eating disorders during the COVID pandemic, is because kids felt like their lives were spinning out of their control. Nothing was under their control. They couldn't go to school. They couldn't see their friends, couldn't participate in sports. They were told everybody's going to die from COVID. There were very appropriate restrictions put on. And the teenagers, though, lost a year of school. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a junior or senior in high school and not be able to go to school. So when things are spinning out of control, some of those kids who are at risk sought to control their own eating. And that went off the rails, which is how they ended up in our program, lost dangerous amounts of weight. And then our treatment is to tell them, you have to lose control over that now. And that has been a challenge. I will say that for our patients who have been able to weight restore and recover from their anorexia nervosa, most of them can look back on the time when they were underweight or in the hospital for it and see how sick they really were. The majority of our patients have expressed gratitude to their parents and to our fantastic treatment team here on helping them through a very, very difficult time. Whether this is because of a true increase in incidence out in the population or what we're seeing is a delay in treatment and a worsening of the severity of illness is unclear to us. Certainly, access to treatment has been disrupted through the COVID pandemic. In our treatment group here, we did not see a decrease in numbers of parents calling in to have their children evaluated for eating disorders at the beginning of the pandemic. That was one of the concerns, that maybe patients are ending up in the hospital because they weren't able to access care adequately and the illness became more severe at home. Maybe the case in some areas, but even though we were not seeing as many patients in person, our clinic rapidly transitioned to virtual care and the numbers of patients seen actually increased through our program rather than decreasing with the COVID pandemic. Even though we have transitioned to virtual care in the midst of the COVID pandemic, and our staff has been amazing in making this rapid shift, we have not seen virtual care in our eating disorders program to be as effective treatment as in-person care. So our program at Mott Children's Hospital uses family-based treatment, which is one of the only evidence-based treatments for anorexia nervosa. And as part of that treatment, in our intensive program, we actually have in-person family meals each day. And that is a key piece that's missing from our virtual care. We shifted over to what we call a virtual intensive outpatient program, which involves about 3 hours a day of Zoom meetings with our therapists, our psychologists, and dietitians, along with some meals monitored on Zoom, but it just isn't the same as being in person.
The prognosis for most children with eating disorders is good. Dr. Bravender explains.
One of the most frequent questions we get asked by parents is whether their child is going to get completely better from the eating disorder. And the quick answer is yes. Eating disorders are treatable. People can recover from anorexia nervosa. And the key is that earlier and more intensive the treatment, the better odds they are of recovering. Eating disorder treatment in adolescents, it can be very, very helpful. That said, there are some people whose eating disorder will linger and become more chronic. In general, we think that about half to two-thirds of patients who get treatment for anorexia nervosa will recover completely. It's no longer an issue. These are the kids who can look back on it in the future and see themselves as being sick and are usually very grateful for being in a better place. A smaller number, maybe about a quarter of patients, recover, they weight restore, things are better, but they remain at risk for developing eating disorder symptoms, particularly in times of stress or in times of life transition. And they may need to be alert that they need some extra help, say, when moving off to college or starting a new job, and be aware that those risks remain there. Unfortunately, it looks like about 5 to 10% of teenagers with anorexia nervosa may end up in more of a chronically ill and chronic illness management state. And those are the kids I worry the most about. And I really do believe that the earlier eating disorders are identified and the quicker we can help kids get back to a healthy weight, the less likely it is that their eating disorder will continue.
Thank you to Dr. Sarah Domoff and Terrell Bravender for sharing their expertise on screen time, eating disorders, and the impacts of social isolation on children during the pandemic. To find out about our other podcasts, go to med.cmich.edu/shiftingmindsets. The Shifting Mindsets for Better Health podcast series is a production of the College of the Arts and Media, the College of Medicine, and the Interdisciplinary Center for Community Health and Wellness at Central Michigan University. Executive producer and host is Dr. Heather Polinsky. Interview recording and editing by Mr. Michael Potter. Produced by Drs. Judy Blabia, Allison Arnold, and John Lowry. Funded by a grant from the Children's Foundation.